Today's Taisho is on case 16 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 16, when the bell sounds. Umon said, "The world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell?" Mumon's comment. In studying Zen, you should not be swayed by sounds and forms. Even though you attain insight when hearing a voice or seeing a form, this is simply the ordinary way of things. Don't you know that the real Zen student commands sound, controls form, is clear-sighted at every event and free on every occasion? Granted you are free, just tell me, does the sound come to the ear, or does the ear go to the sound? If both sound and silence die away at such a juncture, how could you talk of Zen? While listening with your ear, you cannot tell. When hearing with your eye, you are truly intimate. Mumon's verse. With realization, things make one family. Without realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. Without realization, things make one family. With realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. Umon said, "The world is vast and wide. It's a big world. There's plenty to do on a Saturday morning. And you got up, you set your alarm clock, and you got up and you dragged your ass in here to do zazen. Some of you had to go quite a long distance, had to drive quite a long distance to get here. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell? And the world is so vast and wide. It's a big world. There's a lot you could do. Why do you sit on your cushion day after day, day after day, when you could be dancing, traveling, eating ice cream, etc., etc.?" About a week ago, as some of you know, we have a group that sits in the Princeton area, as well as a group that sits here, and a group that sits in Newark, and a group that sits in Oxford, New Jersey, which is up north of Route 78. And the Princeton group was sitting at the Vincentian Renewal Center, which is a beautiful former seminary, which is now a renewal center, which is now primarily serving a lay constituency. It's a beautiful old place, and we were sitting there under the auspices of an interfaith center that was founded at the Vincentian Renewal Center. We had a group at the center, and many of our members, people here today, are come from that group. And recently we were unable to continue there, or probably it was time for reorganization within the Renewal Center itself, and they were redefining their mission, so perhaps the time had come for us to look for another place to sit. Right now we're sitting with Pat Andres at her house in Pennington, New Jersey, and it may be that we're going to be back in Princeton very soon. I'm going to go over on Wednesday and look at a new space right off campus that we might be using. And Pat's house has worked out very well. It's very nice of her to volunteer. It's really very pleasant sitting there. Anyway, there was a person who was started to sit maybe almost 2 years ago. And this person really got into sitting. And then basically when we stopped sitting at the VCR, this person just basically disappeared. And so about a little more than a month went by, and I wondered what had happened. So I sent an email to the person, and I got a reply which was very interesting. You know, this is a person who has a very, like all of us, has a very busy life, and really extraordinarily busy life. I mean, he came to Sesshin once, and at the end of Sesshin had to leave immediately to get on a plane to go like halfway across the country for a business deal. And you know, really has a very, very hectic life, and would come to sit sometimes, and I could see very tired, you know, really very, very tired. And I knew that this was a person who would come and sit in the evening, would be very tired when he sat, would probably get home late because this person lives pretty far from where we're sitting, and has to get up early in the morning and probably very tired all day. And you know, basically I got an email from this person, and you know, was just talking about how he had gotten into Zen over the last maybe year and a half, 2 years, and it had really gotten under his skin in a positive way. You know, if you find that this path really speaks to you, you know, it can really just grab you, and it's wonderful. It's like being in love. I mean, when I first started sitting, I felt that this was something I had been looking for all my life. I mean, I just knew it. It was just instinctively right. And it was like falling in love. It was just like, I don't know any other way to put it. You know, it's like, this is what I was made to do. It's like, you know, if you were a racehorse and you were just sitting in a field and then suddenly you started running, and you realized, hey, I'm a racehorse. What do you know? You know, doing Zazen for a certain kind of person is like that. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, this is what my legs are for. I thought they were for walking, but they're really for Zazen. And it's like, my gosh, you know, this is fantastic. And even if you have discomfort in your legs, even if your back is sore and so on, you know, something about this practice can be very, very engaging because it's speaking from the depths of your being. And, you know, if we listen to that voice, if that's the voice that speaks to us and we listen to it, it can be, it's like love. It's just this, it's like falling in love with your true self. It's not like, that's what's happening. You're falling in love with your true self. And that's a beautiful, beautiful moment to discover the true self and then to fall in love with the true self and start spending a lot of time with the true self, you know. That's a wonderful, wonderful way to live, isn't it? It's beautiful. And you can be with your true self in the moonlight. You can be with your true self at 4 in the morning. You can be with your true self in the middle of the day. Just pull up your cushion, watch your breath. You begin to disappear on the cushion and your true self emerges. It's heaven, really. It's always been there. It will always be there. And you can deepen and deepen your love for your true self, your encounter with your true self. But, and I think this is what happened to this person, you know. But I think, you know, basically, this is a culture. Our society is not a society that says that this is important or even understands this. And a lot of our own backgrounds may not be able to fit with our practice very easily. I myself, you know, my background is complicated, but you know, my father was not a very devout person, but he was a Lutheran. And I remember when I really got into Zen, I brought my father a book on Zen practice. And my father wouldn't even read it, you know. Some people in my family are Jewish, and my father was fine with that, but Buddhism was like over the edge of the world. And I remember I gave him the book, and my father wouldn't even open the book. I left it on the refrigerator, and then I went back to school, and like a year later I came back, and the book was like, you know, sitting where I had left it, you know, with this, you know, sales slip in the same page or something. So he was very upset about my practicing. And even though I, you know, I didn't do everything my father said, on some level I could hear his voice, you know, telling me not to practice. And also, you know, I was a graduate student. I eventually, after I became a Zen student, I went back to school, and I became a graduate student in English department. And I remember one of my friends was very interested in Zen and went to see a very famous professor named Charles Altieri. And Charles was a very famous poet, a scholar of poetry, very, very high-powered, very intellectual. And my friend's name was Jim, and one of the books he loved was a book by a man named Blythe, B-L-Y-T-H-E, and it was called Zen in English Poetry. And Mr. Blythe had been imprisoned in Japan during World War II, and gotten very interested in Zen. And he went back and read Wordsworth and British poetry, English poetry, Keats. And he said, my gosh, you know, there's a lot of Zen Buddhism in Keats and Shelley and English poetry. And of course, Shelley and Keats and Wordsworth had never heard of Chan, of Zen, but the spirit, Mr. Blythe thought the spirit was really there. Basically, my friend Jim went to Charles Altieri and he said, have you ever read this book on Zen in English poetry? And, you know, and Charlie Altieri was not a bad man at all, but he actually burst into laughter. You know, he said, you know, it's like, that's the craziest thing I ever heard of in my life. So my friend Jim was really ashamed. He was really embarrassed at that moment. He felt like he was very naive, and what he believed in was kind of silly. And in my department, if I had mentioned that I was doing Zen, I think a lot of people wouldn't have understood. I think things have really changed. Almost everybody in my department knows that I'm very involved with Zen practice, and everybody treats me with respect. But in those days, things were very different, in my opinion. I didn't get a lot of social reinforcement for being interested in Zen. People in my own family thought I had was going into a cult. And people in my profession, my professional life, thought I was wasting my time. And I have to tell you the truth that you know, it did create some problems for me with my relationship too, my marital relationship. Even though I have been married for 25 years and I love my wife very much, you know, I have spent, I've gone to 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 sesshins every year of my life for 30 years, or 27 years, something like that. So those are times that could have been spent at parties or summer vacations or doing other things, you know. So it created a lot of stress in my relationship. Fortunately, it got worked out okay. But you know, when I got this email from this person who has been practicing so beautifully and so wonderfully, and was really in love, had fallen in love, I think, with his true self, the email was very beautiful and open-hearted. It just said, you know, I need to get some perspective on this because it's so strange. You know, it doesn't really fit with my education or my culture. You know, I'm a business person. I have a lot of stresses in my life and I'm putting a lot of time into this, you know. And I know it's real, but I'm having a hard time working it out in my own mind. Sort of like that. That's sort of what the spirit of the email was. And, you know, my heart, I was really moved by this because, of course, probably everybody who practices Zen has to deal with these emotions at one time or another. You know, everybody who practices Zen has to deal with these kinds of conflicts. You know, on the one hand, you live in a culture that values mostly money and work, professional advancement, intellectual development, and responsibility to family. None of those are bad, actually. So those are all good things in their way, in proportion, in their proper proportion. And Zen is a demanding, beautiful but demanding path. And it could be hard to fit this into your life. It could be hard to make people understand what you're doing. You know, what are you doing? You're not making any money. You're sitting on a cushion. You're not moving. You know. And at times in your practice, it may also seem to you that you're not having much fun sometimes. You know, when you begin to do Zen, it's like meeting your true self, and it's like falling in love. And there's a honeymoon. But after the honeymoon, there's a period where you're really challenged, you know, really challenged. This is the loftiest path, in my opinion. You know, to walk this path requires a great deal of self-sacrifice, and often it requires a delayed gratification of an extreme kind. So you pass your first koan, your breath perception koan, after anywhere from, say, 6 months to a couple of years. If you're a slow learner, as I was, maybe it'll take you 5 years. But at some point, you pass and you go on to your next koan, which is the mu koan. And, you know, depending on your temperament, that can take a long time. And depending on your temperament, that can be agonizing or it can be wonderful. You know, there was somebody else at the sesshin this last time who was doing such a fantastic job with the mu koan. This person has been like a horse who just learned how it could gallop. know, this beautiful, I mean, I have to tell you, you may not know it, but, you know, if you ever don't, if you ever want to stop doing Zen, you know, you won't hurt my feelings, and I'll always be your friend, honestly. But everybody in this room should know that I think about your practice all the time, honestly and truly. I actually think about how to enhance your practice when I'm going to bed at night and things like that. Personally, I think of each person that I've sat with, especially at Sesshin, you know. I rack my brains out about what to do next in order to help you practice. So it means a great deal to me. And this person was doing just a fantastic job at Sesshin. I mean, it was just like watching a horse, a thoroughbred, run. It was just the wind in the wind blowing in her mane and so on. It was like, wow. Every Dokusan, you know, something happening every day on the cushion. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. So, you know, at the end of the Sesshin, this person's koan is mu. And the answer every day, this person's giving me a good answer. Beautiful practice. And then, you know, at the end of the Sesshin, I said, well, keep going. And I could see the person was crestfallen because I hadn't said, okay, you pass the mu koan. You pass your koan. So, I mean, when the teacher passes you on a koan is somewhat of a judgment call. See, there's little mu and there's big mu. See, maybe you're just capable of a little mu. You can come in to see me and I can say, show me your mu, and you can go, mu. And I can say, okay, that's fine. Or you can show me the voice of your true self with your whole being, see. And that's a little harder to demonstrate. You know, people have different capacities. And, you know, sometimes a teacher will say, okay, good enough for right now, given your capacity right now. And sometimes the student gives a perfect answer, and the teacher just goes, great, wonderful, thank you very much. So it's kind of a judgment call. So at the end of a Sesshin, somebody's doing well with her koan, you want to say very good, but do you want to say that's good enough? You know, I don't really completely hear your true self in that answer. But anyway, the person was very crestfallen as a result of this. You know, now, that's a karma, right? Why be sad? You know, it doesn't matter whether you answer your koan or not. What matters is that you practice with your whole heart. So being crestfallen because the teacher didn't accept your answer in Dokusan is a small self, is your small self leading you away from your true self. Don't listen to the small self, please. But we all do, so we get tangled up in our small self and we forget about our true self. But the point is, if you do Zen practice, because you have a small self and because you have karmic baggage we all have karmic baggage that we're dragging around with us, sometimes it's not going to be happy. You know, we're going to practice and it's going to be like in the Mumonkan, in the Gate of No Barrier, Master Mumon says when you work with your koan, it's like eating a hot iron ball. Like swallowing a hot iron ball. You want to spit it out, but you can't. But it's burning. Well, that's a hell of a situation, wouldn't you say? So not necessarily happy all the time when you're practicing. So that too, you know, that too makes Zen practice kind of a challenge. Culture doesn't reinforce it. Culture doesn't say, oh yes, by all means do this. Your intimate companions in life may not say, oh, that's a wonderful and noble path. Institutions say, we don't know what Zen is, that seems nuts. You know, even your therapist may not understand. So, and yet, you know, and you may have a hard time. So, you know, a lot of challenges if you follow this path in life. And this person's email to me was very moving, because this person was loved the true self, but was kind of in a quandary over how to integrate this into his life. And everybody who walks this path has to struggle with that. The world is vast and wide, you know. You could have done all kinds of things this morning, but instead you set your alarm clock, you got up in the dark and the cold, and you dragged your ass in here and sat. Why do you put on your 7-piece robe at the sound of the bell? You know, this is nothing new. You should understand that this situation is nothing new. You know, in China, really, the kind of Zen we practice came out of India. Jhana is what it was called, and it was brought to a very high level of achievement in India. But when it went to China and became Chan, it really exploded. It really became this brilliant, I think the highest spiritual achievement of human beings was perfected in Chan. But you know, in Chinese society also, men and women who followed the path of Chan had a difficult time. Now, Chinese society says the highest thing you can do is be a parent, a mother and a father, and a good member of your family. There's nothing wrong with this. This is very important. But Confucianists didn't really necessarily always trust the Buddhists. Eventually, they became on good terms with each other. Eventually, Confucianism and Buddhism became harmonized. But there was always a lot of tension, or for a long time, there was a lot of tension in Chinese culture, because you were not a familial daughter or son if you became a monk or a nun. You were not serving the family anymore. Sitting was seen as kind of selfish activity, not serving the family, not serving society, antisocial, selfish, so on. Now, you know, I believe that you don't have to become a monk or a nun to practice Zen. Some of the, in the Japanese tradition, Japanese people have made many innovations in Buddhist practice, so that in Japan today, many temples have married monks, and even have dormitories for their families. So in traditional Chinese Buddhism, you were either a householder or you lived in a temple. And you had to turn your back on householder life totally and enter a temple. The Japanese people had a different idea. They said, well, let's bring the house into the temple. I actually think that's a very good idea. They brought the house into the temple. You know, in most Japanese communities, traditional Japanese communities, the playground is the Buddhist temple. That's where all the kids play. Usually there's an old monk or nun who takes care of them all day long, like kindergarten. So actually, most Japanese people have their fondest memories of childhood take place playing in the playground or playing in the grounds of a temple in their neighborhood. So I think that's a wonderful idea. On a deeper level, too, this practice is not antisocial or selfish, even in the slightest degree. In my opinion, when you sit, when you cultivate your awakened mind, you are doing the, you are expressing your love for everyone in your life in the purest fashion possible. After all, you know, you can't really be a good husband or a good wife or a good father or a good teacher or a good boss or a good worker if you're eaten up by anger, envy, selfishness, fear, greed. All around our society, we look at people who are eaten up and destroyed and destroy others because of these inner impulses. Now, when we sit on a cushion and purify our heart, body, and mind, we are doing, I think, the highest service to all the people we love. You know, I don't know if you saw the New York Times, this week they had an article on brain research. There's always a lot of these articles, but it's a new study. There's a big center for science, brain science, at the University of Wisconsin. And they said that, you know, now with various CAT scans and other MRI-type imaging systems, they can see what parts of the brain are activated when you're angry, fearful, and so on. And they can also see what parts of the brain are activated when you're compassionate, you feel connected and alive, and very different parts of the brain light up. So they went to the Dalai Lama and they said, would you like to be in an experiment with your brain? And he said, sure. So they had 157 people from various walks of life, and they find that, you know, you have habitual mental patterns. That is, various parts of your brain are activated more or less all the time or quite habitually during a day, and that's sort of like your normal mental functioning. And in some cases, the anger, envy, fear, alienation parts of the brain are clicking on a lot all during the day. That's sort of like your normal mental state. If you listen to soft music or you're in a peaceful place, your mind will change, but it goes back to its sort of baseline condition. That's sort of like, that's your karma, see? That's who you are right now. That's your mental state. So they did 157 people, but at one end there were, you know, people who were, you know, angry a lot. And they said at the other extreme end was the Dalai Lama. His brain functions were quite distinctive. They said he had the most, the left brain activation, which was associated with compassion, connection, loving kindness, that was the most active in his brain of all the 157 people they used for the experiment. So it was pretty remarkable. They've done a lot of these studies also with Chan and Zen monks and nuns. Years ago, I used to sit with a person named John Sunston who did some pioneering research, and now, when you do meditation, you're really rewiring your brain. You're hooking into the compassion parts of your brain. And you're strengthening the linkages between those parts of your brain and the parts of your brain that do other things. This is well known in brain science that, you know, your brain is not a finished product. Everything you do creates new linkages, new synaptic linkages in your head. And basically, you develop intelligence as you use your mind. So, you know, you're developing Buddha brain on the cushion. You're developing a different kind of mind, different kind of brain when you sit. And it takes time. But it really makes a huge difference. I believe everybody benefits from your practice. There's nothing occult or mystical about it. But if all day long you're going through your life and you're treating people with loving kindness and patience and respect, you're just one person, but it makes an enormous difference in the lives of many people. This is, I think, the farthest thing in the world from selfishness. The world is vast and wide, but why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell? Why do you do it? When I was when I started doing Zen, I didn't really know how to give myself up as a gift to my practice, to life. You know, I didn't know how to live. You know, I thought life meant living fully meant just doing whatever felt good at the time. And I have to tell you the truth, when I first did Zazen, even though my legs hurt, it felt really good to get rid of so much stress and fear. You know, I would sit on the cushion and my stress and my fear would really recede, and it felt like $1,000,000. So once a week I would sit with Genki Roshi at the Seattle Zen Center. And then I would go with my friend Bill Kugler, who also started training when I did. And after every sit, we would sit on a Wednesday night, we'd go sit and we'd finish up around 9, and then we'd go to a bar and we'd have giant mugs of dark beer. And the next day I would get up and I was like, you know, semi-comatose for the rest of the day, you know. I mean, I don't drink a lot. In fact, I mean, I didn't drink a lot then. I haven't had anything to drink in about 25 years since I was ordained. Anyway, so that would be, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 years, something like that. So I didn't understand how to cultivate my true heart and be faithful to my true self. I would sit, and then I would go have this big brewski that would undo all the good clarity that I would achieve on the cushion. And I lived like that for a couple of years. And I would go to Sesshin, and I would get absolutely nowhere with Sesshin. And it really pissed me off, you know. I thought I was trying. And, you know, I would come to Sesshin, and I started sitting full lotus. And a lot of the people in the Zen group where I was practicing didn't sit full lotus. So I became very vain about being able to sit full lotus. So I would sit full lotus, and you know, every sit, you know, and I would have a lot of pain, and I would go to these sesshin, and I would go in to see the Roshi. I was working on this breath perception koan. And I would, you know, I just thought this was really beneath my dignity, this stupid breath perception koan. I wanted a real serious koan, you know, one of the koans that was like really mystical, you know what I mean? Something that would, you know, was really, you know, this is like for babies, right? The breath perception. I wanted a serious koan, you know, like maybe, you know, it would be like an LSD trip or something. Or something, you know. So I would sit on the cushion and I would sit full of lotus and so on and so on, and I would be in a lot of pain, and I would go in to see the Roshi, and I would try to say something profound about the breath, you know. So I'd say, everything is one. I wrote this poem about death. Death is a mirror, luminous clear, that shows the truth when we draw near, you know. And poor Genki, he didn't laugh or anything. He must have just wanted to laugh, but he was so kind, but he just rang the bell, right? Out, get out. So this went on for 5 years, you know. And I just thought, I got mad, went through all the denial, whatever. And then it became my turn to be tenzo, or cook, tienzo. So I didn't want to be the cook for our Zen group. In our group, we used to have big sesshin. We would have like 30 or 40 people show up. So it wasn't possible for one person to cook part-time. One person would give up 6 months of his or her practice and just cook at each sesshin. So you would do two sesshin. Basically, you were appointed tenzo for six-month period. So you'd do two full sesshin and any cooking you had to do in addition, like for a one-day sit or something like that. And I really didn't want to give up my precious practice time cooking. That was for other people to do, not me. So reluctantly, I gave up my practice and did this tenzo job. And for some strange reason, I really got into cooking, you know? And I began to actually try to make decent food for people. And I began to enjoy it. So during the sesshins, I actually made lasagnas. I remember I was doing this full time, you know? So I would just get up in the morning and think, what could I make that'd be really good and tasty and nutritious? So I planned out these menus, and I did a wonderful sesshin, and I would get up, you know, early in the morning and start cooking, and I would go to bed exhausted. I baked bread, I did all this stuff. And I don't know why I did it, you know? I don't know why, it just gave me such pleasure to cook for people. It was utterly mysterious to me what I was doing. And it had nothing to do with Zen, I thought, you know? But then I went in to see the Roshi at the end of the last sesshin, at the end of the term, of my term as a tenzo, as a cook. And he said something that just made me weep, you know. He said, this is the first time I've ever seen you do anything that wasn't totally selfish. And he was right. He was so right. You know, it stung me, but it was so true. And I was crying partly because I was actually happy, you know. You know, part of Zen practice is putting up with these obstacles we all have. You know, sometimes they're social disapproval, sometimes it's 24 hours in a day, sometimes it's serious. Maybe you have physical problems. Some people have serious physical problems, but they practice anyway, even though that's the case. Often, you know, the biggest obstacle to our practice is ourselves, because we haven't really learned how to be totally, to give ourselves totally to this world as a gift without qualification or expectation. You know, when you fall in love with your true self, there's a honeymoon, but then, you know, if you're like me, you begin to say, okay, this is my true self, but, you know, what's in it for me? And the honeymoon's over, you know, and then you start trying to manipulate your true self. I'm going to go to four sesshin, and if I don't answer my koan, that's it, I'm out the door. See, just like a bad relationship, right? So I love you, true self, but if you don't start paying off in terms of answers on my koan, you know, I'm out of here, baby. I'm back to the bar, right? So that's a bad relationship, right? So, you know, we don't really always know. Maybe your karma is a little better than mine when I started practicing, but I didn't know how really to love anything. And I didn't know how to give my... I loved my true self, but I didn't know how to reciprocate that love. I didn't know that real love meant giving yourself as a gift without condition. So I know, you know, it's not possible for everybody to go to every sesshin. That's not what I'm getting at. I know that it's not always possible to come to sit every Saturday. I'm talking about your personal relationship with your practice. My personal relationship with my practice. My personal relationship with my true self. Your personal relationship with your true self. Giving yourself as a gift is the essence of Zen. essence of sin. So, you know, when you're, if your koan is breath, how do you become one with the breath? Give yourself as a gift to your breath without condition. Give yourself totally to your breath. Give yourself totally to your practice. See, in Asian traditions, they have this gesture that we make in the Zendo. It's you put your two hands together. You squeeze your two palms together. This could be interpreted as saying, I honor you, or I salute you. Namaste means I salute you, or I honor you. A deeper understanding of this gesture is, you know, I love you without condition, because you are also my true self. So, you know, when you're watching your breath, you might be sleepy, you might have pain in your legs, you might have a mind buzzing like a beehive full of thoughts, but, you know, you, in your mind, in your heart, you put your hands together and you say, thank you for this beautiful sit. I didn't deserve this beautiful sit. Thank you. See, I give my life without condition to this moment, to this world, to this beautiful path. See, no matter what happens on the cushion, in my heart I put my hands together and I say, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Umon said, the world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell? Mumon's comment. In studying Zen, you should not be swayed by sounds and forms. Even though you attain insight when hearing a voice or seeing a form, this is simply the ordinary way of things. Don't you know that real Zen students command sound, control forms, and are clear-sighted at every event and free on every occasion? Granted, you are free. Tell me, does the sound come to the ear, or does the ear go to the sound? This is a very important question. You'll never answer it unless you become the servant of your breath, the servant of Mu, the servant of your koan. To give yourself with your whole being. If both sound and silence die away at such a juncture, how could you talk of Zen? While listening with your ear, you cannot tell. While hearing with your eye, you are truly intimate. Mumon's verse, with realization, things make one family. Without realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. Without realization, also, things make one family. With realization, also, things are separated in a thousand ways. How can this be? Put your hands together and say, thank you, thank you. Whether it's whole or fractured, whether it's sunny or cloudy, whether it's a good sit, quote-unquote, or a bad sit, quote-unquote, always, always my true self